5 and 6 here, and there was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words, or pompous words, and that sort of thing, and blasphemies. And authority to act for 42 months was given to him, focusing, as we pointed out specifically, on the latter half of Daniel's 70th week, that there are a number of changes that come into existence with the ejection of Satan from heaven, and now his bodily indwelling of the Antichrist. And he opened his mouth for the purpose of blasphemies against God, for the purpose of blaspheming his name and his tabernacle. That is, those who dwell in heaven. Now, the last point we looked at was 32. No doubt Antichrist will attack all the attributes of God with charges that God does not exist or is dead, which attacks the principle of eternal life, is unrighteous or unfair, is a liar, is not aware of what is transpiring, and cannot effectively respond or simply does not care. We have to suspect that one of the arguments of Satan is that God can't be loving and send creatures to the lake of fire. That aspect of the divine essence has to be under attack, because one would have to demonstrate then that they were indeed loving and could still send creatures to the lake of fire and be righteous. And of course, there's other attributes or functions of God that Satan attacks. Obviously, Satan would not accept the fact that he himself manufactured the first sin and evil. So therefore, he has to impute sin and evil to God. You created me evil, that's why I did it. And so therefore, the fault lies with you and not with me. So his whole career really has to be one, from the fall at any rate, one of maligning and attacking God, because he does not take responsibility for his own actions. And that's characteristic of Satan, that he doesn't take responsibility for his actions, that he wants to blame God and lay it all off to him. So 33, there can be little doubt that he will not limit his pompous attacks to the nature of God. Will disparage the character of God as well, i.e. his grace, his goodness, his mercy, which are not what we might call strict attributes of God, but certainly flow out of his love. That mercy and goodness and grace and all of that come from the principle of love. And God obviously chooses how he will function, and he has picked the principle of grace by which to operate his plan, not the principle of works. 34, one would also expect the God-man to be the object of these horrific attacks, as Antichrist will essentially claim to be the Messiah, denying the truth about Jesus Christ and what he taught about his unique person. Or maybe he will claim to be Jesus Christ. Maybe that's the very name he will use. We don't really know. We do know that, again, this gets in very quickly, as it starts out as a political thing, gets in very quickly to a religious worship scenario. And so maybe he will claim to be Jesus Christ come back. Who knows what he says about himself. But what we do know is that, one, it won't really be true what he does say about himself, or will be such a mixture of lies and truth to effectively not be true, and that he will continue doing it. That's the force of this participle, that he keeps on communicating, keeps on speaking these things. 35, the next object of his slanderous speech is described as his tabernacle, which appears to be defined by the phrase that follows and is thus synonymous with those that dwell in heaven. 36, while some translations have placed a conjunction between the final two clauses, his tabernacle, that is, as the New American Standard translated, those who dwell in heaven, essentially making this into three distinct objects of attack, there is none in the Greek. And the New American Standard and the New English translations accurately reflect the final phrase as defining his tabernacle. That's why they supply the words there, that is. 37, from what we have seen thus far in the book of Revelation, those that dwell in heaven would include the four living creatures, angels of various ranks, church-age believers that have received their resurrection bodies, and dead believers of other dispensations that have not received their resurrection bodies. 38, the use of the verb skenao, to dwell in a tent, suggests to me that the permanent residents of heaven, that would be the four living creatures and the angels, are probably not the focus of his attacks, but the recently departed church-age believers. And we've got, and again, we can't really play out the scenario by which they're going to do this, but this has got to be a huge problem to explain this reality of what has happened to all these people on planet Earth. That to just have the church disappear opens up a clearly supernatural window, and supernatural events become, in some ways, commonplace after that. And so, how is he going to explain this away? What's he going to say? Is he going to suggest, as some people have suggested, that the church age believers are evil types and that the masters of wisdom have eradicated them from the planet? That's their code name for the demons that are feigning the angel of light approach. That they have eradicated these people and that they are here to lead us into the paradigm shift has begun and we are now entering into a new age. And it's clear, very clear, say for instance from September 11th, that a certain event could occur on a certain day and it dramatically alters the landscape of the entire world. And the reality is, of course, that I knew that day when that happened that this is a big deal. And obviously, you know, I'm sure a lot of people did, but doctrinally speaking, it was a big deal. I mean, I had to have some time to stop and think and assimilate, is this really the work of terrorists? Are these terrorists really as dangerous as they're portrayed? Did our government know anything about it ahead of time? History would tend to suggest that they did. And I don't just mean recent history. I mean history going back to Pearl Harbor. We've known a lot of things and not done things, or we've allowed a lot of things to happen in order to mobilize the force of American public opinion to get us to do what the government wanted us to do right along. And that was one of the ways we were baited into, they allowed the attack on Pearl Harbor. There's pretty good documentation for this, that they allowed the attack on Pearl Harbor simply because the force of public opinion was against the war at that time, and they didn't want to get involved in a war in Europe or a war in Asia. And so, but if you attack us, well, goodness, you know, now we've got to respond. We're the Americans, for God's sake. And so there's pretty good evidence. I mean, and you can do a lot of research on the Vietnam War, and there's a lot of evidence of duplicity on the part of our government, especially Johnson, who obviously was the New Agers guy. Kennedy got dangerous, apparently, began to think for himself. You can't have that in your president. So now we got W, and you don't have to worry about him thinking for himself. So the point is, there's a lot of evidence of duplicity, of the fact that they escalated things when it didn't have to be escalated. But the biggest things that I think the American people never actually get are these aren't wars. We never were at war in Vietnam or Korea. The last war we fought in was World War II. And we weren't at war in Vietnam. We were just over there meddling in international politics, sacrificing our children for whatever the agenda was at the time. But the global elite knew what the agenda was, and they knew where it was going. So wars are obviously big business, let's face it. Guess who profits from wars? Generally the friends of the president. Generally the people with the big defense contracts. Those who are involved in politics. And you're going to be hearing the mantra for the next 6 months or however long it is till election day, 5 months or whatever it is. Get out and vote because your vote counts. Not as much as the political action committee's votes count, but your vote counts. I'm not disparaging voting. If you think you need a vote, you vote. And you vote for whoever you want. Stewart's always conflicted, he tells me. He doesn't know that whether or not to vote for the most evil guy, since that'll probably advance the agenda faster and bring about the end of all things, or to vote for the good guy in the hopes that, you know, we can survive a few more years. It's a weird way of looking at it, but I understand. So, I mean, who do you vote for? I don't know. Well, if Kerry or Bush, it doesn't matter. You flip a coin. Write in Nader. Nader's not going to be on the ballot, by the way, for those of you that don't know that. He couldn't get the support. So, voting is your, you know, that's your privilege and your right, and you do it as you see fit, and you engage in that under your priesthood. You have freedom to do that or not do it. But you are going to be bombarded with your vote is important. You know, I voted, you know, my vote's not very important because everything I voted for in the last election went the other way. It's at least not as important as the liberal idiot's vote is, apparently. So this whole point of we're going to change things through politics, no, you're not. You're not going to change things through politics. And so he's got to explain away this, though, these church-age believers disappearing. And where'd they go? And why are they gone? And what does all this mean? And So apparently we will become the objects of his maligning as well. 39, this is certainly one of the very real problems that Antichrist and Satan will face. They will have to explain away the rapture, the disappearance of billions of believers from the planet. No doubt, 40, they will paint a picture of the evil in which we were engaged, attacking believers as the enemies of mankind and further progress, and may even claim to have rid the world of the narrow-minded bigots. And the fact is, more and more, as politics progress and as the nature of evil continues to intensify, every principle is under attack. You can't stand against anything. Everything is going to become a hate crime. And by hate crime, they're just saying they're going to escalate the penalties on you if you speak against the queers or if you speak against this or that. If you speak against Homeland Security, what's wrong with you? Are you not a good American citizen? Even though, again, this whole Homeland Security thing and the Patriot Act is a joke, and the congressman never even read the bill, and they ran it through at midnight. What should this tell the American people? There's some kind of hidden agenda here. But, you know, they're, and so that's one of the things that Antichrist will obviously do, very easy to do. They don't, the idea of, you know, I don't know if any of you are keeping up with the RFID technology, but we'll deal with that at some level coming up. But they now, Walmart is going to force every supplier to put an RFID tag on every item that comes into their store. And this gives them the ability to track the item, not only once you've bought it. And so in other words, shoplifting is way, way harder because these don't have to be scanned under, you know, like the little scanner they do when they check you out. These can be read just as you walk through the store. And so if you walk out the door without paying it, they know you got it. And they know right where it is. They can track you. Benetton over in Europe, if you're familiar with them, they do clothes and other things, but they were going to put this on every garment. And people rebelled against it and said, you could track me wherever I went. Well, and here's the argument. Well, if you're not doing anything wrong, why do you care? I may not want you to know where I am. Maybe I'm not doing anything wrong. Maybe I am doing something wrong, and I don't want you to know. But the point is, you should still have your freedom and your privacy. But that's gradually being eroded, as we'll see. So these are radio frequency things, and I was talking to Pete yesterday about it, and Pete said they've now got some pretty good information that these things are going to be down to less than a nickel, so it will easily be able to be put on everything, and it will not add specifically dramatically to the cost of the thing. And so that's where the world's headed, and if you can track somebody by what clothes they're wearing, that's a pretty impressive bit of technology. And so we have, of course, you know, the ability with the OnStar system and global positioning, satellite positioning, GPS systems and all that. They pretty much can figure out where you are and what you're doing if they want to. The problem is, of course, you can't track everybody. And so this all has to be done at a higher level, and that's going to, as we're going to see, is going to involve the money system, because that's one thing you can track people with. And they suggest now, by the way, if you're not aware of it, less than 5% of the transactions in America today involve any cash. And that's in America only, but we're headed the way the globe is headed. And at a certain point, if you do a cash transaction of more than a couple of $1,000s, where'd you get that money? They look at you, and the whole point is, why only drug dealers deal in cash? So if you're dealing in cash, you're clearly a drug dealer. But that's the mindset the American public is getting. I mean, that's the one that's being foisted upon them, too, is that you wouldn't be in favor of, or you would be in favor of this unless you yourself were a criminal. And so that was one of the things, I don't know for those of you who kept up with it, but in Ybor City, they don't just have things at stoplights. Now, if you run a stoplight and they got a camera there and can get your tag and send you a little letter telling you, hey, don't run stoplights anymore, and this is a kind warning. But they've also got cameras set up now at arbitrary places just filming people. And this became a big outcry in Ybor City. Well, what's the problem? Why wouldn't you want to be filmed? What are you doing wrong? Well, I might be acting like an idiot on that occasion, and I didn't want to be filmed. You know, I don't. At times I act like an idiot. I'm sorry. And I like to have my privacy and act like an idiot on my own. I don't want it on tape. That worked real well for me at the 15th, didn't it? So I've be a little more subdued the next 5 years. I'll stop being happy. See, you've done it. You've destroyed me. Now I can't even be happy. So anyway, you know, but the point is that this is going to be kind of the mentality that Antichrist will use as well, is that how can you be against this? There's something wrong with you if you're against this. And the reality is, this is an insane world. And for us to stand up and say it's insane and that we are against it is paints us as the enemy. We're the enemy of progress. 41, modern New Age thoughts recognize that there is really no place for dogmatic truth, as they promote their views that central to the concerns of this thought is the desire to promote understanding and fellowship among people of all races, nationalities, philosophies, and religions. Therefore, all people, whatever their race, creed, sex, caste, or color, are invited to participate as individuals or with any collective environments that share in these basic beliefs and understandings. In following these principles, and the highlighted words here are emphasized by me, in following these principles, there shall be no dogmas, as these teachings point toward the source of unity beyond all differences. Those who understand this will demonstrate a devotion to their own truth, love for all living things, and share a commitment to life without judgment of others. And the whole point here is this unity beyond all differences. This is the ecumenical mantra that's been chanted in the fundamentalist world for the last 20 years, since I was a believer. We've got to drop our doctrinal distinctives and get along with everybody. No, we don't. But that's been the challenge. And I've witnessed a number of people that at one time were on sound doctrine or are nothing more now than just lukewarm, warmed over fundies. They still have the vocabulary. It isn't as though they lost that. They'll still talk about rebound and principles of doctrine and all of that. But in their souls, they've gone back to being fundies. They've gone back to embracing this idea that, you know, the fundies really had it right. And that for us to have ever separated from them at whatever level, and by that I mean just to come out of the camp. And, you know, I separated from them by getting fired. But just to realize, and I realized that very clearly back then, even in when I got exposed to the truth in the early 80s, I recognized, wait a minute, this ain't going to work. There is no unity in these two systems of thought. And as I told you before, try as I could, when we went on the last ski trip we did, I pounded the doctrines down, doctrine and the importance of doctrine, until it was just pablum and mush, and they still wouldn't take it. They still weren't interested in it. And I thought, if you don't see the doctrine of the importance of Bible doctrine, what's that say about your phase two? You don't even understand the importance of pursuing the truth? And the reality is, in fundamentalist churches, no, they don't. They don't, and they don't want to. And so they have their sermons. They sermonize. They go off on this or that. They read a passage. Open your Bibles today to... They use the open window method of study. How do I know where to teach? Wherever the Bible blows open to is a sign from God. And you think I'm exaggerating this. I am not exaggerating. This is the way it's done. I go where God leads me. I hated that, frankly. You know, every week I had to come up, of course that time only three, but I had to come up with three sermons. Now, how did I know what to teach on? I didn't. So I'd just have to pray, all right, God, show me what to teach. I'd get inspired about something, and that had to be it. Well, I like the whole structure of teaching verse by verse and staying with the text better. It relieves all the pressure on me. I just do it in the order of which God the Holy Spirit put it in here. And then, you know, then that rules out a lot of human error there. And human, choices and all that. We'll just stick with what God did. But they don't want that. They're real happy to go in, sing three songs or four or six. And we're not against singing either, by the way. We can sing if somebody wants to lead singing. We've got a piano. But nobody seems to want to do it. So that's your fault, not mine. I'm not, what am I going to do? Make somebody, you've got us lead singing. You're going to apply, by God. You know, well, no, I'm not going to do that. And so we're not against singing, but they'll go in and sing three, four, five, six songs. Then they listen to the choir sing. The choir gets to do their special, you know, so people can get up there and say, I'm in the choir. I get to sing. You sit there and listen. Well, okay, great. Now I'm supposed to be edified by all this, I guess. And yet we still haven't got to the Bible yet. And then finally the pastor gets up, tells us where to open the Bible to. We open it, he reads a verse, and from that point on you might as well close your Bible. Or I can tell you exactly how the sermon will go. It will be 3 points. All of them will begin with the same letter. That's called alliteration. Jesus was the Messiah. He was a man, and he was mad. For what, you know, whatever he might have. And then he'll close with his invitation. Then we'll stand and sing 16 verses of Just As I Am to get you idiots to get up and walk down this aisle so you can, one, either be saved, or two, get right with God. And we'll do this regularly. This is going to be our whole approach. And we'll close it all with a prayer, and then we'll go eat and hope we beat the Methodist to the cafeteria. That's the way it was. I did it for years. And, you know, so the point is, this whole thing with the truth, they're not interested in it. They're not interested in doing it right. They're just basically warmed over fundies, and their whole deal is unity. That's their mantra, unity. We got more in common with the fundies than we admit. No, we don't. And maybe some of you weren't fundies or weren't fundies long enough. But those of us that have been drugged through the mud, kicking and screaming, and got out and got washed off, I ain't going back. It's a horrible system. And for people that are supposed to know better to pass it off as sound doctrine, come on, give me a break. I was in it. I know specifically what it was. And I saw it at a bunch of different levels. I saw it in the Church of Christ. I saw it in the Catholic Church. I saw it in the Methodist Church. I saw it in the Southern Baptist Church. You know, I was exposed to various forms of religion through all this. And guess what? It never, ever worked. I got involved with the Charismatics for a while. Okay, it doesn't matter what you believe. We'll just all stand here and hold hands and pray. Okay, what are we going to pray? Well, they never really knew. And you ought to hear some of the prayers these people come up with. Dear God, bind Satan today. Let him loose again tomorrow, I guess, so I can pray for you to bind him the next day. No, God, bind him permanently. Wait a minute, God isn't answering that prayer, apparently. Not yet, anyway. So, you know, heal all the marriages. Heal the many, many sick. Make them all well. Make the poor rich. Is this edifying? Does this communicate? Is this anything about what the Bible says to be doing? No, not at all. And so this again has permeated the religious environment. It permeates the secular environment. Let's just, you know, as Rodney King said, why can't we all just get along? Well, you shouldn't steal cars, for one thing. That's part of what hurts our unity, brother. We can't have you stealing cars and running from the cops, crackhead. Smoking crack and committing crimes is part of the problem with unity. Or what are you suggesting? We all smoke crack and commit crimes? Then at least we'll all be on the same page. So then you got all these crackheads out stealing crack from one another. Or money to get crack. You know? Those of you who watch Dave Chappelle can appreciate this. He's got a character on there. He just loves crack. Well, the point is, yeah, this tends to divide us when you're committing crimes against me, when the police think you're dangerous. I give you number one rule. When the police come after you, don't run. It just makes you look guilty. And, you know, but generally speaking, you know that feel. I mean, if you've ever been stopped for a traffic ticket and you knew when they pulled you over, you knew, you know that feeling, though, you get when the lights come on and that siren? And you pull over, and you know you did it. You know you're guilty. Well, what do you think you should do then? Wait till he gets to the car and then just try to run? Oh, slam the door open on him, knock him over, and then take off? Yeah, see how that goes for you. Well, yeah, this is a real problem with unity when we have people that do this. I don't want to be unified with those people. I think you should just take your medicine, take your ticket, and pay it. Or you can go to the court and fight it if you really think you're innocent. I've managed to fight a few in which I was guilty and still won. So you never know. You can take your chances, but running? I didn't see that as the way to go. And back in my younger, wilder days, when I did get actually arrested one night, I had a motorcycle wreck, and I couldn't conveniently sit in the back of the police car, and I asked, can I stand outside? He goes, no. I'm afraid you'd have to run, and then I'd have to shoot you. I'm crippled. I got bad legs. Well, he was a mean cop, and I don't think he liked me. So what are you going to do? Well, I didn't think of getting out and running, I can tell you that. Because something told me he would have shot me. And now today, of course, now, you know, even if they're shooting back at you, you can't draw your gun and fire back. I saw up here this deal that happened up by Tom's house there at the edge of the county line. You know, they had cleared all the cops on it, but I'm like, there's guys out there shooting at me, and you got to question whether or not you can draw your gun to take care of yourself? I'd rather the cop, you know, I don't want them to shoot first and ask questions later, but under that situation, why do we have to investigate that? It should be obvious. So again, we're going to share a commitment to life. We're not going to judge people. There's going to be no doctrinal distinctions. We're going to live beyond all differences in total peace and unity. Well, sounds good on the surface, but at what cost? Well, the cost of all this is the truth. That's the only thing that suffers, is the truth. 42, some have suggested that his blasphemous attacks will consist of making fun of the goodness and righteousness of believers and those that have sacrificed their lives for Jesus Christ while the beast and his followers live in the riotous pleasures of sin. That one was spoken by a true fundy. You can tell just by the nature of the wording. I never find myself thinking of the riotous pleasures of sin. 43, this type of activity, well, I do sometimes. I can't talk about it. This type of activity is quite characteristic of megalomaniacs, a psychopathological condition characterized by fantasies of wealth, power, or omnipotence. People that have grandiose delusions. You've met a few of those, have you? Who have been recognized throughout history as being tremendous orators. These people, say Napoleon, Stalin, Hitler, and many others, have an ability to manipulate the crowds that listen to them with passionate and articulate speech that appeals to the mental attitude of the mob. And so, people know this. I mean, if you watch John Kerry this week, he was over there at the NAACP. Now, is this name not outdated? Do African Americans really want you calling them colored people? And yet they continue to use this name, which is, to me, the ironic double standards that exist out there. You can say it, but I can't. Oh. Okay, how come? How's that happen? But anyway, Kerry knew how to play to them. He said, well, some of the candidates don't want to come and talk to you. I wonder who he meant. Well, Bush snubbed them because their politics are liberal and totally against their basic values at some level. And so he snubbed them. But Kerry knew how to appeal to them. And they all clapped and applauded and went crazy. And, oh, we love you. Okay, you got the black vote. Or can I say the colored vote? How should I say it today? You got the African vote? Well, there's no one here from Africa that I've met. And the ones that I have seen that are here from Africa are like Ernie Els, big tall white guy. And Retief Goosen. They're from South Africa. So the point is, what's politically correct today? Well, it may not be politically correct tomorrow. How do we know? So these people know how to manipulate, they know how to play to the crowd, they know what the crowd wants to hear, and they know exactly how to whip them into a frenzy. 45, we certainly know that psychotic leaders need to find a release for their tensions, inner conflicts, and frustrations. And this often involves transferring their frustrations to a chosen enemy. 46, and this is one of the things you have to be very, very careful of. I mean, we all get frustrated, we all have problems. You can make people out to be the enemy when, in fact, they're not the enemy at all, simply because you just need a release for your frustration. I'm frustrated, and so I make somebody out to be an enemy when, in fact, they're not my enemy at all. I've done it. And it's stupid. And you got to realize it's stupid, and it's wrong, and it's dangerous, because then you're making people an enemy that aren't enemies at all. And that's completely out of line. That's losing touch with reality. And so these people have to have somebody. It's easier to motivate and unite people if you have a common enemy. And as I like to say, certainly sometimes nothing unites people more than just a common hatred for something. People, you know, common hatred makes for some strange bedfellows. I've seen it. People, if you can get somebody to hate the same thing, even if they hate each other, they'll come together to hate that thing or that person. And I've seen it happen. And so if I can get enough people to agree with me that I'm right, therefore it makes me right. No, it doesn't. And that's one of the dangers. You can't assume you're right just because a lot of people agree with you. And some people, that's all they do. They'll run around and they'll try to convince everybody they're right. And if enough people agree with them, well, then they're certain they're right. Well, watch yourself if you fall into that, of trying to convince everybody you're right. Because, you know, sometimes we're just flat wrong. All of us. From the pastor right on down. And I have to, and that's one of the dangers of power and authority. You get in a position of power and authority, well, I can never admit I'm wrong. Because then the sheep might think, well, he's not perfect. As if you did before. You always have, though, right? You've always harbored the secret fantasy that Ron was somehow perfect. And then you met me. Well, guess what? You have to admit and acknowledge your shortcomings and deal with them, and you've got problems just like other believers got problems. And it's nice to, you know, one of the things that's very safe and convenient and comfortable, and I found myself doing this a lot in the early stages when I was on doctrine, is if enough people agreed with me, especially if the pastor agreed with me, I must be right. Which presupposes, of course, that the pastor can't be wrong. So you're busy trying to get people convinced you're right. Number two, it's easier to have this sort of smug, I've got it all together attitude than admit that sometimes the Christian life is just hard. And sometimes I don't have all the answers. And sometimes it's difficult and it's challenging. And sometimes I want to throw up my hands and quit. But, you know, I kind of adopted more of the, you can count on me, Lord, I'll be there at the end like Peter did. Others may go negative, Lord, but not me. And then it finally dawned on me after some growth and discipline and lots of time that, you know what? I'm just as capable of peeling off and being an idiot as anybody is. I don't like to think that, but it's true. And so you have to come to grips with your own mentality, your own mortality, your own weaknesses, your own failures. And it's easy to walk around and think, oh, I've got it all together, because that's emotionally more comfortable. But is that the reality of life? And the reality is it's not. So here's the way they organize people, get them going. Transfer your frustrations to your chosen enemy. And if you don't have an enemy, make one up. We call that the straw man approach. You build this straw man, and you impute all manner of evil to it, and then you beat the crap out of him for being this evil. And people get off on this. 46 here, the 8 basic steps for creating an enemy and mobilizing public opinion. A, pick a group that is different. Emphasize any and every difference in religion, culture, class, race, etc. Well, you know how those Italians are. You know how those Jews are. You know. And just pick out, just pick out any difference and then magnify it as best you can. You know. And then impute evil to it. Just assume, but because it's different, it must be evil. Well, just because things are different doesn't make them evil. B, once these differences are established, continue to reinforce them with all disseminated information through the state-run media. Remember, in times of conflict, all for-profit media, by the way, that's every television show you watch, every channel you watch, maybe public broadcasting isn't for-profit, I don't know, but 99 out of 100 channels you watch are for-profit entities. In other words, their bottom line is money. Their bottom line isn't the truth. The bottom line is money. And guess what? In times of conflict, all for-profit media repeat the ruling party's information, leading all for-profit media to become state-run. Guess who determines what news we hear on World News Tonight between 6:30 and 7 every weeknight? Who tells Peter Jennings what to say? How is it determined? Clearly, we can't get the whole world in 30 minutes, so certain key things are picked that they want us to hear. They want certain things reinforced, and we keep being exposed to them over and over and over again. They keep repeating the mantra, we're at war, we're at war, we're at war, we're at war. And now pretty soon, if you will listen to people talk, you'll hear your average person say, well, during times of war, we're not at war. But if enough people keep saying it, it becomes the truth. No, it doesn't. It doesn't become the truth. See, show this enemy in actions that seem strange, militant, or different, and always portray the enemy as non-human and evil. By the time the propaganda machine, let me ask you this. Now, what is your opinion of Osama bin Laden? And yet none of you have met him. None of us have met him. We have no idea what he thinks. We're told what he thinks, how he acts, how he lives, and this is all just assumed to be true. And we don't know. There's pretty good evidence that Milosevic wasn't at all the butcher of the Balkans he was made out to be. But how do we know? Our government said he was evil. He had to be taken out. How about Hussein? Did he kill some of his own people? Well, none of our presidents have ever done that, have they? No, they just have other people do it. They keep their hands really clean, lily white. Yeah. Yes, leaders have their people killed sometimes. Do I need to remind you about the Tuskegee experiment? Are any of you familiar with what's going on in the mind control realm in our country? And Operation Monarch and some of these other things that have been exposed of ritual abuse and satanic Luciferian things and all of that, systems and rituals. And people say, well, oh, you're one of those conspiracy nuts. No, I just adhere to the fact that there are two views of history, the accidental and the planned. Now, you can think history's just an accident, one big long accident that keeps happening, or you can come to the reality that people plan things, and that's why they happen that way. And so, did we ever think for a moment, by we, I mean our government, our leadership, did they really think Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, or did they really know all along he didn't? And they just wanted an excuse. Well, it's catching up with Blair. I tell you, the Brits have turned on him. That dog is gone. He ain't going to hunt no more. And they're going to get rid of him because they know he was in Bush's pocket. And so they've had enough of it. See, sometimes people actually do catch on, which is kind of an astonishing thing. B, eliminate opposition to the ruling party by creating an atmosphere of fear. Create an us versus them mentality. Leave no room for opinions that differ. And perpetuate the lie that one does not have to support all the actions of the ruling party, or the one that does not support the actions of the ruling party should be considered a traitor. E, use nationalistic and or religious symbols and rhetoric to define all actions. This can be achieved by slogans such as freedom-loving people. Now, are you a freedom-loving person? Or are you a freedom hater? Well, that implies that if you're not a freedom-loving person, you must be a freedom hater. Well, guess what? There's all kinds of things in between there. But see, it's got to be black or white, right or wrong. And everything isn't like that. But you can create an environment in which it is, and if you ever question anything or suggest that it might be opposite, heretic, and get rid of them. And that's what they'll do. And that's exactly where this is headed, politically and internationally, too. Flags are very often very effective in this regard. F, align all actions with the dominant deity, recognizing it is very effective to use terms like it's God's will. God is on the side of right. And guess what? We're right. So therefore, ipso facto, God's on our side. Or God bless our cause, whatever that may be. G, design propaganda to show that those in your organization have feelings, hopes, families, and loved ones. Show the soldiers as they're coming home being reunited with their families. Now, who's against that? Show them picking up their little puppy. Everybody loves puppies, don't they? Do you hate puppies? How come you can't see? Look at this poor guy. Make it clear that those in your organization are only doing their duty. They do not want or like to kill, but yet they're willing to do it. All in the name of might makes right. H, create an atmosphere of fear and instability and then offer the ruling party as the only solution to comfort the public's fears. Remember that the fear of the unknown is always the strongest fear. What are the biggest fears in your life? And if you'll think about it very long, you'll realize that it's the fear of the unknown. It's what you don't know. It's not the things that you do know that you can see and kind of figure out. Your greatest fears are what you don't know, what you don't understand. And so guess what? I don't know or I don't understand. I've got all your answers. Okay? Be very wary when people tell you that. They know all the answers. I'm not even sure what all the questions are yet. But they've got all the answers. Well, the reality is in many cases the answers are given in order to force you to what they want you to be, want the question to be. They sometimes work backwards. How do we know that ADHD is a legitimate disease and not just a psychological name made up by psychologists? Well, because we got a drug to treat it. And guess what? Many of these diseases don't become diseases until they got a drug to cure them. And it's almost as though one could get the idea that the pharmaceutical companies make drugs and then create the disease later that they're curing. When did heartburn become a disease? And I'm not saying people don't have some legitimate gastrointestinal problems, but you know what? I solved a lot of my heartburn with liquid aloe vera. I don't have to take that $4 purple pill, which, by the way, is suppressing your stomach acid to the point of making your body pH dangerous. Your stomach is acidic for a reason, and it stays acidic unless the drug companies decide they don't want it acidic. So then this begins to affect your digestion long term. And does cholesterol really kill people, or is it God? You say, well, when did cholesterol become a disease? And the reality is, I'm not saying that fatty deposits in your bloodstream help you. I'm not taking that viewpoint. What I am saying is that when they're giving them all these lipid drugs, the reality is they're setting them up, and they tell you straight out front, do not take this drug if you have liver disease, liver problems. You need to take regular liver tests. Why? Because the drug is going to destroy your liver. But by God, you're going to have the best cholesterol in the world. Well, what's the trade-off? If I'm going to die of high cholesterol and a heart attack, or I'm going to die from liver failure, why pay to die from liver failure? Why not take the free disease and let it kill you? I mean, if you got it, well, and look, like I said, the good news is we're all dying. Some of us may be faster than others. So why not take the free disease rather than the one you got to pay to get? So, and, you know, the whole point, and like I said, the whole thing is just insane. And they offer us, these are your solutions to problems. We can cure depression. When did depression become a disease? You know, these people that are broke and their husband just died and they don't have any insurance, they should be depressed. That's normal. But we can't have depression at any level. If you have these symptoms for, you know, 3 or more days a week, you know, then you're depressed. Well, who defines depression? Well, again, not doctors. It's not a medical condition. It's not something you can run a test for. I mean, we can do a test and find out what your cholesterol is. We can do a test and find out what your hormone levels are. We can do a test and find out what the levels of certain elements are in your body. I mean, these are objective tests. How do I know if I'm depressed? Take the following test. Are you sad? Anxious? Are you irritable with people? Who isn't? I live in latter-day America. I live in a society where people don't even know how to drive a vehicle, and yet they're given a driver's license. And am I irritable? Yes. Am I irritable when somebody stops in the middle of the road because they realize they're in the wrong lane and they sit there holding up traffic with their signal on until they can do what they want to do? Am I irritable that people run red lights and almost hit me? Yes. Look, you should be irritable if you live in America, especially given the nature of the culture and all that. But, you know, you need Prozac, buddy. You need to calm down, and Prozac is just a drug for you. Now, we used to think it was Valium, but we came to find out Valium was addictive. So what we did was we took Valium pretty much off the market. It's still there. You can get it. Diazepam. And we substituted Xanax, which is equally as addictive, but we're not going to tell you that. And so it is long-term just as dangerous as Valium. And people take it all the time, and but they're the normal ones, right? No, I don't think they are. So again, create an atmosphere of fear and instability, then offer this as the solution. And again, what people don't know, that's what scares them. Do you know what the future holds? Guess how they sell us all this insurance? You don't know what the future holds. You better plan ahead. I'm not against insurance, by the way. But to think that insurance makes you safe, that's the wrong mentality. It doesn't. 47, one must understand that the conflicts here are not simply dreamed up by the Antichrist. They are real and have existed for millennia. The conflicts between right and wrong and good and evil and God and Satan, these aren't new. 48, as Antichrist maligns those that have left the earth as being evil and unfit for society's needs. It will be quite easy to transfer this hatred and public opinion to the believers that still reside on the earth during Daniel's 70th week, and that's where our next verse is headed, which we will deal with on Wednesday. It is time for us quarterly here to observe the Lord's table, so if you would get everything in place for that, we will do that.